Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Squawk 1200. I'm Zach.
I'm Wellis Mike.
And we are joined by our third guest today, Jill Marlow, the Associate Center Director for Technical at the Langley Research Center. Thank you so much for joining us here on Squawk 1200.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Glad to be here.
So you were mentioning a couple of the programs that you're dealing with out there at Langley now. Why don't you bring our listeners up to speed on what you're working on?
Sure. So at Langley, we're one of NASA's research centers, so we're all about thinking about what's not possible today that we want to try to make possible tomorrow. And in the context of aviation, a lot of that has to do right now with supersonic flight and trying to bring back supersonic flight to overland. Our work there began quite a while ago, a couple of decades ago, where we were talking about what would it take to actually make the boom a little bit softer on the ground so that it wasn't so disruptive to folks. So actually figuring out how can we reshape the vehicle to make that boom tolerable on land. And now you fast forward to today, and we've got the X-plane that is in production, and I know you guys talked with our test pilot a little bit earlier today. What we'll be doing is actually taking all of the data from those flights, from people on the ground who are experiencing that boom, and figuring out what is it that is tolerable, and how can we actually take that data and translate that into standards that then the FAA would actually make that flight overland possible. So that's one of the things, you know, and that's all that work, a couple decades of work to make that possible again. And obviously the test flights themselves are the big eye candy, but a lot of hard work leading up to that and a ton of hard work after that to actually turn that into policy so that we can all pay for that ticket and take that ride, right?
I have to admit the Concorde is one of the coolest planes, to this day, one of the coolest planes I've ever seen. When I was little, I thought it was just the greatest thing since sliced bread. What's your sense of whether this technology is going to become commercially viable in the future? I know you can lose a lot of money betting on the future, but as you look at it, is this a pathway toward commercial success, or is this more in like a military government context?
No, we're definitely thinking it's a pathway to commercial. So a lot of the companies that we partner with now, NASA doesn't do anything alone, right? A ton of partners, academic partners, industry partners, and even getting in now into crowdsourcing with the general population. And so those companies are actually looking at viable commercial business models for this, but the key is overland. That's why the Concorde didn't work out. Not enough routes, right, to make that viable for them just flying over the oceans. And so that's the key. That's one of the reasons we're focused on that.
And with the reduction in sound, when is the actual test flight going to be so we can actually hear what all your data turns into?
Yeah, so it's coming up in just a few years in Dallas, right? That's going to be our first market. And so it will not be that long. And they're very much trying to work the communication. So it'll be in terms of making sure the public is aware of when that's happening. And right now we actually have simulations. We've done an awful lot with computer simulations to be able to predict what is it going to sound like on the ground. And you can actually go online on NASA's website and hear it for yourself now. And then when we actually fly, we'll get to match that up and see if our predictions were accurate.
Do you then also go back and compare the actual sounds to your predictions so you can make predictions more accurate in the future?
Yes, absolutely we do that. It's interesting because it's not just a question of decibels, right, how loud it is. It's also frequency, and there's a whole field that we work in that's called psychoacoustics, which is how does our brain interpret sound, and it's basically the study of annoyance. I know anybody would probably agree that a sound of a mosquito is a lot more irritating than a vacuum cleaner. So it's really processing what is it that a human would find tolerable. So it's not just volume, it's how annoying is that sound. So we have a whole scientific program in that.
I swear the car makers, they study that also, but to make the most annoying sound when you don't put your seatbelt on.
I think you may be right. Exactly. So it's not just the supersonic flight either, right? One of our dreams is to, as we call it, on-demand mobility, right? That's the vocabulary. And it's really all about how can we fly anyone, anything, anywhere, anytime, at any speed. And so, you know, looking at that, it's everything from what are the regulations that are going to be required to make drones fly wherever we want, and then getting into urban air mobility, huge conversation around that. For that, we're looking at a lot of autonomous flight. And again, it gets back to the idea of what does it take for a human to actually trust something that's flying truly autonomously, not automated, but where the machine itself is making the decisions on our behalf. And so a lot of research in trusted autonomy.
In studio with us right now is Jill Marlow, the Associate Center Director for Technical at the Langley Research Center, NASA's facility out in Virginia. I'm curious what you said about psychoacoustics and all this. I know you're on the engineering side of things, but what sort of work does NASA do on these programs to sort of get ahead of public opinion. In other words, if you just showed up in Dallas and launched the airplane with no public comment, people would be upset almost no matter how good it was. On the other hand, if you do some outreach work, that might take care of it. What's that project like at NASA?
Yeah, so they've been doing extensive outreach with those communities, working in the communities. There's actually all kinds of different, I guess the right way to say it is like regulations with getting approved to do testing in a community and making sure that everybody there knows what's coming and knows how to engage and interact with that. So that's been going on for quite some time. One of the folks that's actually with us out here at the NASA booth in the pavilion is actually one of the principals. So I would encourage anybody that's really interested in finding out about that to head on down to the pavilion. He can talk with you about it. His name is Kyle Ellis.
How does some of these programs relate into current commercial operations and reducing noise levels at airports where people live around?
Right, yeah. So a couple few years ago, we wrapped up a program called the Environmentally Responsible Aviation Program. And that program was all about how do we deal with three things. It was how do we make flight more affordable, so through primarily a reduction of fuel burn. That got into lightweight structures and materials and new ways to control the aircraft, all of that type of thing. A reduction in emissions from that, and then third, the reduction in noise. And so a lot of what they were doing there was treatments on like landing gear and also trailing edge flaps, those types of things that are the main sources of noise, and actually looking at how can we retrofit some of that stuff so that it will actually make a less irritating sound footprint at the airport so that airplanes and airports can be better community neighbors.
Yeah, because that's one of the largest complaints that the airlines get is, I don't want that airplane flying over my house.
Right, NIMBY, right? Not in my backyard.
Exactly.
I know one of the big areas of research right now is rotorcraft and tilt rotors. We've got the return of counter-rotating props with like a pusher propeller and things like that. Is NASA investigating in that, especially in what you talked about with kind of urban on-demand sorts of things?
Yeah, so the X-57 Maxwell is one of the vertical lift and transition to horizontal flight vehicles, right? So we're looking at electric propulsion being a huge enabler. There's a lot happening, too, in the rotorcraft community as well. But when we talk about urban air mobility and actually thinking about how can we go into cities and all of that congestion on the ground, how can we combat that, right? You can either go under, right, to build more roads and that kind of thing, but we think the better option is to go up. And so that's going to require vertical takeoff and a transition to horizontal flight to get across the congested areas and come back down. And so we're doing a lot of work in that area. Electric propulsion is one of the huge enablers. And of course, we have that other X plane out there working on that activity.
And then to talk about you personally a little bit, you're a Virginia Tech grad, did aerospace engineering, but your first job was actually with Electric Boat working on nuclear submarines. How did you end up beneath the water and then come back above the clouds with NASA?
Yeah, well, so true disclosure, I actually grew up sailing on the Chesapeake Bay, and it was trimming the sails and thinking about, you know, the direction of the wind and how to propel the boat that hooked me into aerospace in the first place. And my year at Virginia Tech was the very first year that they made people either choose to major in aerospace or ocean. Previously, it had been you were an aerospace and ocean engineer.
Okay.
Well, being completely conflicted, I chose to double major. So I actually have an ocean engineering degree and an aerospace engineering degree.
Gotcha.
And I ended up getting recruited out of college to go to Electric Boat. And what I did at Electric Boat was I worked on everything that was outside the pressure hull. So that included all of the trim surfaces and the superstructure, basically the parts that look like an airplane, but on a submarine. So that's what I did there. And then when my husband got relocated down to the Norfolk area and NASA was there, no engineer that's ever had a dream to be an aerospace engineer can resist the pull of NASA, right? So I actually got an offer to come to NASA, and I flipped over. And other than the switching from having an intuition on 3-inch thick steel, which is the submarine intuition, to aerospace materials, which are rather a lot lighter and rather a lot thinner, the knowledge transfers pretty well.
Excellent. And what are your next projects after the supersonic stuff that you're working on?
Yeah, so we have a lot of things in the hopper that are relating to autonomy. We have an awful lot that's is relating to manufacturability. So how do you think about the density of aircraft that we're expecting in the skies with urban air mobility and all of this? there's a lot of manufacturing at scale that needs to get addressed because all of those vehicles, of course, have to be certified. And how can we do that? So looking at the power of additive manufacturing and advanced manufacturing techniques. I know we've got a talk going on this afternoon at 2:30, I think it is, on aerospace materials. We're doing a lot of research in that area. And then an awful lot, too, with autonomy. And an awful lot with airspace. How do you actually deal with the density of traffic and where can we innovate in airspace and applying autonomy to airspace management as well?
And how do all those things, work with inside urban areas like New York? And if, let's say you want to do a vertical takeoff and do a vertical landing. How does all that work and everybody not hit each other if we start throwing thousands of vehicles
and
in
that,
there?
My friend, is why we call it research. Yeah, there's a lot to be done there.
Do you think, and we're coming up towards the end of the segment here, that within, let's say, my children's lifetime, we will see airplanes be like taxis, where you just pop over and say, oh, I need to pick up an airplane that's going to take me down to Chicago or something like that?
I absolutely do. I absolutely do. I think it's going to start in some of the urban areas with being able to do that, and it probably will start with those who can afford it, but I think it is going to be democratized, and I think we're going to actually see our kids or even our grandkids never knowing a time when that wasn't available.
Wonderful. Jill Marlowe of the Technical Center at Langley Research Center, thanks so much for joining us on Squawk 1200.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It was great to have you. You're listening to EAA Radio, 1210 AM, 96.5 FM, and streaming at EAARadio.net.